Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue in Cincinnati, Ohio, in our School of Jewish Studies. We're really excited to be here again. We are meeting on Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock p.m. to 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, and we're exploring Eim Habanim Smecha, this fabulous work by Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal. And I'm happy to say that we are going to continue our side study. We did it last week, and we're going to conclude it today. We're studying an academic article by a professor named Mati Inbari, which was published in the Jewish Quarterly Review, volume 107, number 4, and that was published last year in the fall of 2017. And the article is called Messianic Expectations in Hungarian Orthodox Theology Before and During the Second World War, a Comparative Study. And so if you were with us last week, you know that we looked at the Munkacher Rebbe, Rabbi Shapira, and we enjoyed getting to know him a little bit, Rabbi Chaim Elazar Shapira, the Munkacher, who was born in 1871 and passed away before the war, 1937. And today we're going to see our author of Eim Habanim Smecha, Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal, who was born in 1885 and passed, we're told over here, in 1945, although it's not so entirely clear to me exactly what year that was. It could have been 44, but, you know, it was during the Holocaust that he passed. And so, if you were with us last week, that's great. If you missed it, I recommend strongly that you find the recording of it. Ask sheerenjoyment.org, see if you could find it. It was dated June 17 of obviously this year, last week's class. Today, let's get started with his treatment of our author, Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal. So we've already seen the Munkacher in his approach, extreme, rabid anti-Zionism, an insistence that everybody's got to do tshuva, and that is what's going to bring the Mashiach and the Geula, the redemption. Let's see what our author of Eim Habanim Smecha, Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal, see what he says, and let's see how Professor Inbari deals with him. And so we're on page 519 in the academic article. If you somehow have it, great. If you don't, I'll do the heavy lifting. Here we go. Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal. Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal was born in Hungary. He studied at the Pressburg Yeshiva and later became the Av Beis Din and chief rabbi of Pishtian in West Slovakia. The rabbi was a follower of the Munkacher Rebbe and shared his views on the importance of religious strictness and opposition to Zionism. However, Rabbi Teichtal argued that the role of a leader is to find solutions for the distress of his followers, even if this requires a measure of religious leniency. And like we did last week, there are lots of footnotes. The major footnotes, I'll either say footnote and let you know that there's something out there you should look up, or maybe I'll even read it. This is a footnote by Yitzchak Hirschkowitz. He wrote an article in Hebrew called The Halacha as a Tool for Policymakers. The freedom of ruling and the responsibility of the ruler in the teachings of Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal, published in Dine Israel in 2009, yes. So you're going to see that Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtal, our author of Eim Habanim Smecha, has made quite a splash in academic circles, and there's a lot of stuff written about him. It really is remarkable. We continue. In 1942, due to increasingly severe anti-Semitic persecution, Rabbi Teichtal fled from Slovakia and arrived in Budapest as a refugee. He began writing his treatise, Eim Habanim Smecha, which is translated to A Happy Mother of Children, while he was still in Slovakia, before the deportations to Auschwitz, and without understanding the full scale of the Nazi persecutions. And by the way, the phrase, Eim Avanim Smeach, he didn't just make it up. As we've said many a time, it appears in the Book of Psalms. We say it on holidays in Rosh Chodesh. The impact of his situation as a refugee left a mark on the subsequent development of the manuscript, which he only finished in 1943. In 1944, hearing a rumor that the deportations from Slovakia had ended, he decided to return, but was apprehended by the Nazis during his journey, and he died on the way to Auschwitz. My understanding is, according to our own book in the intro, one of the introductory essays wrote that he stood up for a fellow Jew on the train against some Ukrainian soldiers, and they were so infuriated they just beat him to death on the train. He wrote most of his book in an attic in Budapest, and as a result, many of the sources he quoted were from memory alone. Friends, it is completely crazy, remarkable, and stupendous that a man could write such an incredible magnum opus like he wrote, virtually all from memory. And when he says, you know, I don't have the safer in front of me, and I think this is what it, I mean, try to write a book from memory, citing other sources, and make a book out of that. Do the best you can. How's your memory shaping up? I mean, how much have you memorized that you're able to actually have so much swimming around your head that you can bring it up at a moment's notice, and it's virtually 100% accurate? I mean, the whole thing is just an incredible, incredible thing. This writing of this book is beyond. It's just beyond. In the book, which of course we're studying, in the book he discussed the changing times, and he criticized Hungarian Orthodoxy for taking the wrong side on the question of supporting Zionism. Although he could not have foreseen the extermination of Hungarian Jewry, his book, published just a year before that extermination, included a powerful lamentation on the decision made by Orthodox leaders to instruct their followers to stay in Europe. Footnote: some Hasidic leaders ordered their followers not to leave Europe, yet they themselves escaped it, leaving their followers to deal with the Nazis by themselves. See a book in Hebrew by Mendel Picard called Ideological Trends of Hasidim, of Hasidism, Ideological Trends of Hasidut in Poland during the interwar period and the Holocaust, in Hebrew, published in Jerusalem in 1997. There was, right on YouTube, there's a famous video of a rabbi blessing his people. Everything's going to be great. You're going to see. You're wonderful. You're from. There'll be no problem over here. You're not going to be bothered by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. But I got to leave now. And if you'll excuse me, there's a train I got to catch. He escaped. They were all exterminated. How do I know if they all were? But, I mean, a good number, sadly, were. And it's just unbelievable. So your heart goes out. Rabbi Wasserman, Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman, who was in America at the time of the outbreak of the war, I think, had the guts, if I'm allowed to say that, returned to Europe, and he died with his students in Baranovich. He went down with the ship. I mean, he could have stayed in America. It would have been safe for him. But he went back to spend his last months and years with his students. Rabbi Tachtal confessed that he had once held the same view, this anti-Zionism approach, but stressed that he had now changed his mind. If you have the article, we're on page 520. In order to explain the transformation in Tachtal's position, we must first explain his original views. The book Tikkun Olam, edited by the students of the Munkacher Rebbe, included numerous expressions of opposition to Zionism, and to Agudas Yisrael. Among other contributions, the work includes a brief letter of support from Teichtal. Tikkun Olam was published in 1936, and his letter was written close to the time of publication. In it, he argues that the essential purity of the land of Israel is covered with impurity. Teichtal distinguishes between the earthly and the heavenly land of Israel and argues that it is impossible to win the earthly land without first purifying it. The only way to do this is to adhere to the religious way of life. Any attempt to gain the land without holiness as a Zionist would achieve nothing, since the land is, quote, a land that devours its inhabitants. Those are the infamous words of the Meraglim in Parsha Shlach, which we just read recently. They came back from a description. They came back from a tour of the land of Israel, and the description they gave it was, it's really something. And then they said, oh, but by the way, it's a land that devours its inhabitants. Only God, he writes, can remove the shell of impurity, and this depends on repentance. According to his approach, the secular Zionist pioneers were unworthy of the land. Teichtal concluded that no human action or conduct will enhance the value of Zion and Jerusalem until, quote, God sends from heaven a spirit of cleanness by way of a miracle. In his letter of support, Teichtal repeated a set of positions that accord closely with those held by the Munkacher. In Mishneh Safchir, a collection of his weekly Torah sermons from the period prior to World War II, Rabbi Teichtal expressed ideas in close step with those of the Munkacher, that trust in God would bring sudden and immediate redemption, that redemption can flourish outside of nature by way of a miracle with the help of the righteous tzaddikim, that Torah study is important, even at the expense of making a living, that the pious should segregate themselves from the modernizers. Shmuel Weingarten, who was the Mizrahi's chief secretary in Czechoslovakia prior to World War II, and who personally knew Teichtal, testified that Teichtal belonged to the Munkacher's followers. Quote, and I knew that anyone who fell under the influence of the Admor of Munkacs was as if hypnotized by him, and no powerful persuasion in the world could release him from the trance that the Rebbe placed him in. Yet by 1942, the rabbi had changed his mind. In the introduction to Emabonim Smecha, Rabbi Teichtal argued that the Zionist question had not been a major focus of his interest when he wrote against the movement. I was busy teaching students and writing essays, he declared. He noted, and that's what he writes in his book, Emabonim Smecha, he noted that in the Talmud, sages at times confess their mistakes. Accordingly, if a man believes that his views are correct, he should not refrain from presenting them, since, quote, the truth is key. In the appendix to the third chapter, written just before the publication of the book, he added that his earlier letter had been written, quote, in time of peace and tranquility, when Jews did not face mortal threats. And that's just fascinating in and of itself. I mean, if you have a Torah approach on things, does it really matter if the Jewish people are going through hell on earth? The Munkacher didn't see the hell on earth that the Holocaust brought. But I have a funny feeling, contrary to Rabbi Teichtal, I have a funny feeling that the Munkacher would not have changed his mind. But maybe I'm crazy, maybe I'm just plain wrong. Rabbi Teichtal saw the incredible atrocities perpetrated by the Nazis in Machshimam, and he said, I think I got to change my mind. But how do you change your mind just based upon the reality that you see in front of you? I mean, that is, to me, something of an interesting thing to explore. How do you change, how does one change a shita just because reality is setting in or is harsh? Now, Teichtal says that he was not the only one who changed his mind or would have changed his mind. Moreover, Techtel argued if Rabbi Shapiro, the Munkacher, were alive today, quote, he would also have said that we should leave the lands of exile and move to the land of Israel, that the kings of the land have offered us, that is the British Empire, and we shouldn't wait for the call of the Messiah. I think that he's alone on this one. But because the impression I get from the Munkacher is that he was some sort of you know, radical purist who was never going to change his mind no matter what. But maybe I'm wrong, and maybe Rabbi Techtel is right. We continue. In his book, Techtel presents several personal testimonies that allow us to look more deeply into his change of heart. In the year 1942, a ruling was issued by the authorities in Slovakia to kidnap all unmarried Jewish girls over the age of 16 and to transfer them to an unknown place. At the time, Techtel was writing, the fate of thousands of girls remained unknown. Accordingly, he decided to call his book Eim Habanim Smecha, A Happy Mother of Children, as an allegory of a land happy to see her children return in peace from their wanderings. Fascinating idea. I would have thought that it's only because of the land of Israel. Talking about Sion, Yerushalayim, Eim Habanim Smecha, Hallelujah, that Yerushalayim should once again be, and Sion should once again be a mother of joyous, a joyous mother of children. You know, initially bereft of children for 2,000 years, and then everybody comes on back and rendering her Eim Habanim Smecha, a happy mother of children. Okay, but it's a fascinating idea about these young ladies, and if we read it earlier, I forgot about it. Okay, we're on 522 in the essay, if you have the essay. Techtel also described the confiscation of Jewish property. Every Gentile who sees an item that belongs to a Jew is allowed to say, give it to me, and the Jew is forced to give it to him, and thus all the Jews were left naked and with nothing, end quote. He described the confiscations of lands and houses, deliberate starvations, and deportations to Auschwitz, which he defined as a land of exile, since at that point he was unaware of the actual destiny of the deportees. He had no idea that they were going to get killed over there. He emphasized that all his descriptions were, quote, like a drop in the sea of cruelty that they have done to us without a reason, only because we're the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, end quote. Techtel's personal diary, which survived the Holocaust and was published by his son in 1994, includes additional testimonials regarding the persecution of Jews in Slovakia, some of a personal nature. One of the more horrifying passages recalls how he was captured by the police, taken to jail, and subjected to physical torture. And there it is. It's published in Hebrew, out of Yerushalayim in 1994, Faith Tempered in the Holocaust Furnace, by Yisachar Shlomo Techtel. That was his personal diary. In the second introduction to the book, Techtel wrote that the troubling times did not allow him to concentrate on Semitical subjects, not least because all his students had been deported and he remained alone. Accordingly, he decided to study the subject of the Messiah and formed the definite conclusion that the end times, the Kates, Ikvah of the Mashiach, we're going to see that in a minute, that the end times, the Kates, the ends, were about to begin. He's of the conclusion that the end is about to begin. Funny, but not so funny. However, various obstructions were preventing the Messiah from appearing. Thus, one purpose of his book was to explain the severity of the situation and to offer a correction. In rabbinic literature, the ikvos of the Mashiach, the footsteps of the Messiah, are described as a miserable period, characterized by spiritual and material decline. Tractate Sanhedrin states that the Messiah, son of David, will come only in a generation that's either entirely guilty or entirely innocent. See Sanhedrin 98a. That is Perek Chelek, something I think we ought to start teaching over here in our shul. Fascinating Gemara there. Implying that redemption could come even in a completely wicked generation, either entirely guilty or entirely innocent, implying that the redemption could come even in a completely wicked generation. The Talmud also states, Beito Achishenu, quoting the prophet, in its time I shall expedite, meaning that if the Jews have merits, justifying their redemption, then redemption will come speedily. If not, redemption will still come, but only, quote, in its time, in its appointed time. Tackle calculated the end, determining that his days were at the end of the sixth millennium, and thus the Jews had reached the predetermined date established by God for their redemption. Quote, we are living in the year 1943 of the sixth millennium, in Hebrew 5703, and we have certainly already reached the period of Beito in its time. From the year 5500, which corresponds to the English year 1700, the time of the Messiah has begun. But according to all opinions, we have already passed two-thirds of the sixth millennium. Thus is already, quote, we are in Beito in its time, end quote. According to the Messianic model based on the Talmud and Sanhedrin, the prevailing physical and spiritual condition prior to the coming of the Messiah must be wretched. The rabbi curtly assessed that, quote, there's no shortage of baseness in our days, yet the Messiah had still not appeared, and accordingly Tartel attempted to ascertain what might be holding him back. Quote, we need to investigate and to understand what is the matter that is stalling him from us. In order to explain his point, the rabbi tells the story of a chassid who did not want to get married. Why should I marry? Asked the chassid. And he received the answer, in order to have children. The chassid replied that he would go to the rebbe and give him a note, a kippel, the traditional way for chassidim to ask the rebbe to pray on their behalf. The chassid went to see his rebbe, and the rebbe told him, I guess he read the kippel, and the kippel says, please bench me with children. Benching a single guy, very tough bracha to give. What should a man do in order to have children? The rabbi told him. Should marry a wife. And that explains a cute vort that Dr. Nati Horowitz, an Israeli physician who spent a couple of years here at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, said in the name of his Rosh Yeshiva, one of the Hasidic yeshivas, whose name I absolutely just forget, I'm so sorry, but the rabbi was quoting a Medrash, and the Medrash says that Isaac had a twin sister. If Isaac had a twin sister, so why did Abraham go to all the trouble of sending Eliezer and the whole contingent to go find Rivka all the way wherever she was living, I don't know, in the Ramam Narayim, Chreis in Mamandeh, Chreis Syria. I mean, why are you going all that way? You have a girl right here, he has a twin sister, so marry the guy. Marry Isaac, his twin sister. So what are you doing spending all that time, money, and effort? Abraham, what are you thinking? Answer the Rosh Hashiva, Isaac wanted to marry a woman, not a midrash. Okay, we continue. Rabbi Tachtel interprets his own story by emphasizing that prayer alone is not enough. Actions are also required. Quote, if a man prays on something, it's not enough to pray alone, even if the prayer is with great devotion, until he would take action and do what he needs to do. And only then will heaven help him get what he wants. I assure you that those two things are absolutely required. Prayer without action gets you nothing but prayer. Nice, but all you're doing is saying tefillas. And if all you do is act, but you're not praying to God to get into the right mindset, who knows what the result will be. So you've got to do both, and then you'll be rewarded with success. Take it from me, friends. Take it from me. Bottom page 523 in the academic article. In this parable, Rabbi Tachtel confronted the passive principle of orthodoxy, which seeks to expedite redemption by prayers alone and opposes any political action of conquering and settling the land of Israel. The next few words are strange. As we saw in Shapira's polemics, challenging the religious leadership of his generation, and particularly on the part of the Munkacher Rebbe, that last half of that sentence is very muddled, and I don't know why the editor let that through. That is not well-written stuff at all. All we're going to try to say is that Rabbi Tachtel confronted passive ultra-Orthodox Jews. He was fighting against the Munkach's polemics, and I would have written, and he thereby challenged the religious leadership of his generation, particularly on the part of the Munkach Rebbe. That's how I would have edited that sentence. Now we continue. I mean, I'm a former proofreader and editor, and like when I see stuff like that, it drives me crazy. Tachtel argued that leaders must think of the common good, that the troubles facing the Jews of his generation were the result of bad leadership. Quote, all the blows we endure in exile were intended to awaken us up to return to our Holy Land. End quote. He continued, quote, we need that the beginning of action would come from men, and later God would support it. End quote. This approach echoes the ideas of Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who was born in 1795, passed in 1874, who was considered one of the harbingers of Zionism. Kalischer proposed several stages for human-led redemption, including the ingathering of a small number of Jews in the land of Israel with the permission of the nations and the reinstitution of the Pesach sacrifice on the site of the temple. These human actions would be complemented by God. They wouldn't be complemented. Oh, good job, good job, good job. No, complemented. They would be added to. You do an action, God will complement it. He'll add on to it his task, his job, his action. You do your action, God will complement that with his. These human actions would be complemented by God according to the principle of mundane actions cause sublime actions. Tachtel developed this approach and proposed that with the ingathering of exiles in the land of Israel, with the permission of the British Empire and the support of the League of Nations, a third temple should be built on the Temple Mount by the Jews. Wow, quite a difference. For a former Munkacharian, he developed an approach that with the ingathering of the exiles, with the permission of the Brits and the support of the League of Nations, a third base of Mikra should be built by the Jews. Then would the Messiah bring down a heavenly temple from above, thereby completing the mundane action. And indeed, he quotes down a source. The Messiah is going to go on top of a temple and scream out, Anovim, Anovim. That song that we've been talking about in the past by Yitzchak, by Green. Yitzchak Green. And so where, what do you mean? What kind of temple is the Messiah stepping on top of? So the answer is, first the base of Mikdash is rebuilt by human beings, by Jews. Then God sends down the fiery messianic temple. Then Mashiach comes 40 years later. Wow. Or whatever, however it's going to go down. Thus we see that Tachtel now supported emigration to the land of Israel. Since there was no doubt the messianic time had come, the promises of redemption would soon be fulfilled. As I discussed above, rabbinic literature presents different models for messianic realization. Tachtel sought to abandon the miraculous and apocalyptical model accepted by Hungarian Orthodox rabbis and to replace it with a naturalist model. He explained, quote, how redemption will appear, with a miracle or with nature, is all dependent upon our actions and behavior, end quote. Redemption may come suddenly and miraculously, or it may appear in the form of a long and gradual process. Quote, our true sages have already shown us that unlike many of our people who imagine and desire that the Messiah would appear to Israel suddenly like a flashing river or from darkness to great light immediately, their rise will be little by little from one step to the other. He goes on, quote, our master and rabbi, the holy genius, author of Minchas Elazar, Blessed Memory from Munkach, with all due respect, I must indicate that he viewed all things from a meritorious perspective based on his lofty standards. Yet in truth, this last generation, due to many transgressions, is not worthy. Redemption is therefore destined to be disguised in the natural process, end quote. He criticizes the Munkach Rebbe for holding that redemption must come only by way of a miracle. Tachtel agrees that this is the proper situation when everybody repents and the entire nation is as righteous as the Rebbe. However, since the situation of the nation is not as desired and is therefore not worthy, redemption still will come, but through a gradual process. It's worth noting that Tatzel's criticism of the Munkacs' approach on this matter was published only after the latter's death, the passing of the Munkacs. First, the Munkacs passed away in 37, and then this was published. But then again, I'm not sure what that point is, because this was Rabbi Tatzel only had a change of heart. He only had a change of heart when he finally saw what was going on in 42, 43, and then he writes the book in 43 and 44. So, of course, that's 7 years after the Munkacs passed away. That's when the Tatzel himself had a change of heart. So there's nothing nefarious about waiting for the man to die and then publishing it. The man passed away years before Tatzel even had a change of heart. Let me just write that down. Okay. Top of page 525 in this essay, Tatzel was aware of the prohibitions made by the sages against calculating the end. However, according to his understanding, it was now permitted now to act to force the end. It is permitted, he writes, and allowed, and timely of us to ask these questions as to how long the road should be. In the introduction, he encourages his readers to take a vow to raise the glory of the land of Israel and to commit to move there after the war. Quote, we must vow to return to our Holy Land. We must try to reestablish its glory. Then, too, its merits will release us from our distress quickly in our days. Amen. End quote. Emigration will force God to fulfill all the vows, and exile will then end. The classic model of messianic activism. That's the Mizrahi approach. Tatzel attacked the traditional expectation that the Messiah will carry the Jews to their homeland, quote, on the wings of an eagle. He calls it a despicable opinion and a desecration of God's name. To support his case, he quoted Maimonides, who argued that Jews must not rely on a miracle. Tatzel went on to argue that the expected miracle cannot appear to the Jews who are living in exile, since the, quote, spirit of cleanness that supposedly will allow Jews to repent is impossible during the state of exile. This argument embodies the complete reversal of his earlier statement in Tikkun Olam, when he argued that the impurity that covers the land of Israel will not allow life that's unholy in it. Now he's saying that Israel is fully holy, but everybody is unholy and unclean in the rest of the country, of the world. And he now argues that impurity covers Gentile lands, and that this prevents repentance. Thus, Tatzel adopted the Mizrahi religious Zionist argument that repentance will come at the end of the messianic process, that tshuva will come, according to the Mizrahi approach, national tshuva will come at the end of the messianic process, but not at its beginning, because at the beginning we still have millions of people who are not from, and they're not going to become from overnight. No matter what we try to do, it's not helping. But what are they going to do, tshuva? At the end of the process, and then the Mashiach will then come on the scene, at least according to my understanding of it. He further challenged the Orthodox argument that no good can come from the settling of the land of Israel by Zionist pioneers who don't keep the Torah and the commandments, by arguing that the pioneers' actions are an example of a commandment that comes through transgression. Okay, again, the Orthodox argument is that the pioneers are doing a commandment, a mitzvah ba aveira. It's a commandment that they're doing, yes, but they're doing it through an aveira. They're doing a mitzvah through an aveira. He writes, even if the builders of the land in our days are committing sins and deliberately defying the will of God and not keeping the commandments, still God welcomes their actions of building the land with love and great affection. End quote. In contrast, the Munkacs disassociate himself from the pioneers due to their secular ways, and as a result, abandoned the idea of building the land through human effort. For him, it is better to be in a state of sheva al tasa, sit and do nothing, rather than build the land with transgressors, wrote Rabbi Tatzel. Our author, Teitel, went on to emphasize that pure nationalism is insufficient, since the Jewish nation is distinguished by its commandments. Nonetheless, Teitel thought that if the Orthodox cooperated with the Zionists, they might be able to influence them from within, so that the pioneers would work according to the spirit of the Torah. If the believers moved to the Holy Land in their masses, their influence would grow, and this would help keep the land holy. He concluded, "We need you and your actions, but you should know that you need also Torah sages." Here he's talking to the Chalutzim, pioneers of Palestine, turn of the century. One of the main debates in early 20th century Hasidic discourse concerned the proper approach toward Jews who had abandoned the Torah. Most Hasidic rabbis, including the Gera Rebbe and the Alexander Rebbe, argued that such offenders continued to form part of the Jewish people despite their offenses. Accordingly, the sinners retained their Jewish essence, and efforts should be made to bring them back to the fold. Leaders of the radical ultra-Orthodox movement, however, among them the Munkacsa, refused to accept this lenient approach, condemning and even demonizing those who transgressed religious law. An argument against Zionism articulated by the Munkacsa and repeated by Teitel in his letter published in Tikkun Olam was that the land of Israel is, quote, a land that devours its inhabitants and will vomit out Zionist sinners who desecrate Shabbos. Teitel later reversed himself. Quote, one should not call the immigrants in our days ugly or wicked, heaven forbid, or condemn their actions, or speak against them with contempt, because they were privileged to build our land and to make it bloom. Indeed, Teitel devoted much of Emibar Mismecha to a condemnation of the separatist tendencies of Hungarian Orthodoxy. He attributed eschatological meaning to Israel's unity and claimed that outreach to non-believers has the potential, that outreach to non-believers has the potential to expedite the redemption. Quote, you must love even the worst man in Israel to unite the hearts and to push away anything that brings divisions. For the salvation of Israel is dependent upon it in times of trouble. End quote. Teitel attacked the ideology of hatred that is associated with Hungarian Orthodoxy. Quote, don't be a stupid and foolish chassid to speak ill of Israel and to bring divisions among the believers. End quote.
And that means people of Israel.
People of Israel. Quote, and he continued with declarations of love. Quote, even though the wicked among Israel are traitors, heaven forbid, still they do not cease to be the children of God. And thus, it is a commandment to love them and to bring them closer with great affection. And thereby, we will reach salvation. End quote. In his eyes, those who left the traditional lifestyle are considered, quote, a baby in captivity, a tinok shenishba, a halachic term used to refer to Jewish people who, for reasons beyond their own control, did not study and therefore do not know how to follow Jewish religious law. Such persons are not held liable for their behavior. Since the 19th century, this term, tinok shenishba, has been used by Torah scholars to grapple with the halachic status of secular Jews. We continue on page 527 in the article. The unity of Israel is a precondition for redemption, and it can only be achieved by emigration to the land of Israel and observance of the commandments, Teitel concluded. He confronted those, quote, who act with evilness and detestation to make us hate our precious land, end quote. Amazing thing to say that people are making us hate the Holy Land of Israel. That's an amazing thing. Some makes you want to hate the secular Zionist government, but nobody wants you to hate the Holy Land of Israel. I mean, maybe we ought to think about that. Hate the precious land. I mean, is that what they were saying? He adopted a punishment and reward approach model, claiming that the opposition to Zionism causes bitter exiles whose end cannot be seen. Hechtel advocated the development of a counter-propaganda mechanism and even offered to study how this technique was applied in Soviet Russia. That is in the Abram Smith. I don't know if we saw that. To conclude, Hechtel came to reject the overall approach of Hungarian Orthodoxy, which opposed Zionism and encouraged retreat and segregation, relying on the expectation of miraculous salvation. He adopted the naturalist messianic model, typical of religious Zionist thinkers, and he argued that by following this model and by emigrating to the land of Israel after the war, the Jewish nation could secure redemption. I've got a few minutes left, and we only have a page left, so I want to be able to finish up this article, and then I'll take questions, and we'll do a last-minute conversation about it, and then I got to go to a closing. Discussion, I'm on page 528 in the article. The Munkacher and Rabbi Teichtel lived in the same period and in geographical proximity. They were both inspired by the rabbinical worldview of Hungarian Orthodoxy, and both were strict rabbis in accordance with the tradition of their region. Based on the severe deterioration in the condition of the Jews in Europe and Talmudical analysis, each believed that messianic redemption was imminent, and calculating the end of days, they both took actions to expedite it. Teichtel's vows, meaning as moving to Israel, and the Munkacher's magical prayers. In trying to explain the delay in the coming of the Messiah, the Munkacher blamed the modernizers, the Zionists, and even Agudas Yisrael, while Teichtel blamed the Hungarian Orthodox leadership, and especially the Munkacher Rebbe himself, for refusing to support naturalist redemption. It is important to note that neither blamed God. The furthest Shapira could bring himself, the Munkacher, was to suggest that God was indifferent to the miseries of the Jews, thus expressing mild protest without shaking his ideological foundation. Footnote, over here there are two articles of psychology talking about how psych research has demonstrated that presenting some minor anger toward God can be a sign of strong relationship. There are two articles. Maybe we'll do that in Gulf Manor Synagogue. I mean, we'll get to it maybe one day. Okay, but Teichtel, one second. Benjamin Brown interestingly notes that by the 19th century, all the Hungarian rebbes had adopted a highly nomistic approach. Hasidic leaders defended the halacha and adopted the ultra-Orthodox approach. The most radical of these figures was Tzvi Elimelech of Dinov, Rabbi Shapira's great-great-grandfather. However, among these rabbinical circles, a doctrine of holiness of sin had also developed, and Rabbi Tzvi Elimelech of Dinov was one of the advocates of this approach. He argued that actions undertaken l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven, even if they constituted an aveira, a transgression, would nevertheless count as good deeds. Traditional, amazing. So then where's the problem for secular Zionism? Can you say that? Traditional rabbinical literature forbids actions intended to hasten the end times. Based on the research on the Munkacher and Rabbi Teichtel, it might be hypothesized that taking action to draw the redemption closer could be understood as a, quote, holy sin. It is possible that their fervent belief in the imminence of redemption, combined with a deterioration in the state of Jewish existence in Hungary, combined with deep conviction that their own intentions were pure and sublime, pushed them to transgress this prohibition. And in these cases, we find a continuation of Hasidic traditions that go beyond the limits of strict norms. That's a heavy one. For both rabbis, the miseries of the Jews were proof of the messianic times. Applying a Deuteronomic model of reward and punishment, the Munkacher understood the troubles as divine punishment for the abandonment of the religious lifestyle. For Teichtel, current woes constituted a divine punishment for neglecting the commandment of settling the land of Israel, after God had opened up the opportunity to do so following the Balfour Declaration. In the teachings of the Munkacsa, we can identify a continuation of ideas that were advocated by other Orthodox leaders of that time prior to the Holocaust, among them Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman, head of the Baranovich Yeshiva, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the sixth Chabad Rabbi, and his son-in-law, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. These rabbis argued, each with his own nuance, that the rise of Haskalah, Reform, and Zionism brought a declaration of war on God, and as a result, caused the divine punishment of the persecution of the Jews. They also believed that the miserable situation of the Jews indicated that the Messianic times were fast approaching. After the Holocaust, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who became the leader of Chabad, found it difficult to repeat these arguments, and instead offered different explanations, arguing that humans cannot fathom God's ways. Even more, he said that Jews should not give victory to Hitler by abandoning their religious way of life. Thus, he established a massive outreach operation to bring sinners to the fold of religion. After the war, Schneerson adopted approaches closer in substance to those of Teichtal, who argued that every Jew has an inner spark, and therefore there's a need to reach out even to sinners, including Zionists. Chabad has developed an extensive network of emissaries who operate throughout the Jewish world to draw Jews closer to its version of Jewish heritage. And we wrap it up here. On the other hand, the Munkacsa's successor as the head of the Hasidic radicals, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe, took the anti-Zionist approach into the extreme. The two leaders shared an anti-modernist approach and a profound opposition to Zionism. They both negated any Jewish activism in the land of Israel that was not devoted solely to Torah study. Like the Munkacsa, the Satmar also believed that he was living through the days preceding the arrival of the Mashiach, and that his generation had reached such a nadir that the only rational conclusion was that the just Redeemer was about to appear. However, the differences between the two figures are striking. Rabbi Eilish based his anti-Zionist approach on the Talmudical legend of the three oaths, and therefore claimed that the Holocaust was a divine punishment for the sin of Zionism. He opposed any action to expedite the end, even on the spiritual plane. The Munkacsa, by contrast, did not put much weight on the three oaths with his opposition to Zionism. Moreover, he devoted himself to a spiritual endeavor to expedite redemption and bring the end. Thus we see that the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel caused a change of mind among several Hasidic masters who survived the war, though not all of them. The underlying fault lines of disagreement remained. This essay has highlighted the importance of messianic expectations among Hungarian Orthodoxy prior and during the Holocaust. The differences of opinion on spiritual questions had tragic practical ramifications. And that ends the academic article that we spent last week and today on. I have about 5 or 10 minutes. Rabbi Berlev is here. I mean, we won't be able to do justice to this, obviously, but I will give the article to Rabbi Berlev for him to review if he'd like. It's his to look at.
I have a few comments on this.
By all means.
First of all, the writer of this article, I don't think, realizes that already from the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, the so-called Friedika, there were very strong signs that he was reversing, not necessarily anti-Zionism, but in terms of the Tinoch Shidishpa business, because a lot of the, I would say, the underpinnings of the very large-scale programs that the seventh Rebbe, as a Zichrono Livracha, started and spent his life's work on, were started already by his predecessor, by his father-in-law, with the the American Chinuch, which the seventh Rebbe I believe he was the administrator of it, the head of it, while his family was still alive. But you know, the whole idea, and there were many. I think the Talusos. I'm not sure. Long in the Yontif, which Rebbe started, Christ thing was the seventh. I'm not sure if it was the seventh or the sixth. But it's known that the sixth Rebbe already showed signs, and in fact, there was already a rebellion by a small group of Chabad, who are later known as Malachim, because the acronym of the very dynamic Rebbe, I'm told, who founded that group, was called the Malach, it's the initials of whatever his name and title was. I felt that the sixth Rebbe already was going away from it. So it was a very big change in Lubavitch. Lubavitch always tried to pretend that this basic structure that the fifth Rebbe still held by, which would be basically a sattva position, was still in place, but you have to interpret it and understand it and so on. Just like, for example, when the fifth Rebbe gave a diatribe against modern Hebrew, as did the Sattler, of course, Sattler and Kodis. So the seventh Rebbe wanted to make a drush on the word Makariah for refrigerator. So he quotes his grandfather, whoever it was, if he wasn't that close, his closest ancestor, the fifth Rebbe, as saying that that modern Hebrew is not Lashon Kodis. But then the seventh Rebbe adds, since it's close, resembles us in Kodesh, so it is not beyond the pale of reason to make drushes from it. That's one point about Lubavitch. Second point I want to make is when he talked about the holiness of sin, I personally believe that Chassidus HaBesht has a very strong concept, very strong conflicting traditions they draw from, and there's a lot of tension. If you're a positive adherence, you could say creative tension of undercurrents that, to me, are not necessarily reconcilable. And in this one under discussion, on one hand, you have the idea of Godel Avera, that Avera that is done for the wrong reason is perhaps more holy than a mitzvah, done for the wrong reason. And by the way, it was against that idea that I actually spoke it to the luncheon for my grandson's bar mitzvah, that I said that part of his heritage ancestry is Litvish, part of it is German, and one point which both certainly agree with is that we don't agree with this point. I didn't mention the Chassidus. I don't want to knock anyone explicitly, but I wanted to let him know that no part of his background or heritage is there any room for that. But you have this in Shabtai Tzvi, particularly the radical for Shabtai Tzvi, the epitome being his conversion, of course, and Geshem Shalom and others talk about whether there was a direct connection between some of the later followers of Shabtai Tzvi and Chassidus HaBesht, whether there wasn't, but there seems to be some sort of continuity. There's something there. And there was an undercurrent, absolute undercurrent, in Chassidus HaBesht. The longtime house mother of the YU High School dorm, Mrs. Fanny Weitzenberger, told me that she came from Vienna. Between her family and her husband's family, I think, half were very strict misnagdim, the other were Chassidim. And she said when it came to halakhic adherence, the misnagdim were stricter than the Chassidim. On the other hand, the latter-day Chassidim, Chabad is their own story, but in terms of Chassidim generally, particularly the Hungarian ones, if only because of geographic proximity, and they interacted with many Hungarian Chassidic rabbeim, we have to remember, doubled as community rabbis. Satmar being a good example of that. I'm not sure about maybe the Moon Country. So they interacted very in all levels, including formal levels and conventions and so on, with organized. You know, the Haredi rabbinate of Hungary or whatever border it was officially in at a given time and place. And the Chasam Sofer influence, you know, he and his students, was overwhelming. They were the ones who were holding the fort, Chomas Hadas. So, of course, the Chasam Sofer, notwithstanding his Kabbalism, as we know, was a very, very strict adherence to uncompromising halacha, of course, especially any halacha that was in danger of being trodden upon by the reformists and similar groups. So that Hasidim, particularly Hungarian Hasidim, not to exclude others, but certainly Hungarian Hasidim have a very big underlying tension between Gadol Aveir Lishma and there is no compromise with halacha, even in the most minute detail. And you find it comes out in many different ways. My own personal observation is, well, you have to study the details of when one is gober, when one predominates, when the other does. I think a lot of it is almost capricious and arbitrary, depending on the particular Hasidic authority. He'll say, here we have a Masorah, we don't have to worry, and there we have to be extra strict. Sometimes it has to do with those things that were cost to leverage to be lenient on in the more modernist circles, so they went the other way and defended the strict halacha. Whereas in things that were kind of neutral in terms of value, I don't say value neutral, but it didn't have any connotation with modernization, so reciting piyutim, fasting at the yahrzeit, things like that, they could afford to be lenient, and have the other approach dominate. So you have a very different thing. It's interesting. I have to check the genealogy again. Either this Moonkutcher, Shapira, or his son, I believe, had a daughter who married a rabbinowitz. The story was, whether it's true or not, is that in spite of the yachtus and everything else, the Sattler and Mooncatcher hated each other personally, whatever it was. And the story goes, I heard this in, where did I hear it? I forgot. The Mooncatcher cursed the Sattler and said, you will never have children. Sattler cursed that. You will, but you will have these, you'll have kids, but your descendants will be Zionists. I heard that story. And then when I was in Camber Yavne, there were two young men, Bokharim, 20 and 21, who dressed and acted just like regular Israeli yeshiva Bokharim, among the best of them, but still nonetheless modern Israelis with modern clothing and so forth. Came Shabbos, they wore the Hasidic coat. That's my picture of Dabar. This is family background. The one, the name didn't ring a bell at all, probably Hasidish Balabatim. The other one's name was Rabinowitz, and I found out that his father was a son-in-law of one of the Mooncutchers. Okay, well, he married a Rabinowitz, and I believe he was even in line to be Mooncutcher Rebbe, but then I don't remember the sequence, whether he was first a rabbi in Israel or in South America, but he was in both those places. And in Israel, he really gravitated and became a member of the official Rabbanut. Okay? So
both of them are Kohanim.
Right, exactly. Then I saw the product. Great guy. So you look up, I should confirm that by Sharfstein. He knew exactly who the guy was. And he said the guy never rebelled against his Mooncutcher heritage at all, only the circles that he traveled in and the path that his career took gradually became more of a modern, rabbinic Zionist rabbinate.
Fascinating. Yishar koach. Rabbi Berlov, as usual, thank you so much for that insight. Big yishar koach. God willing, we'll meet again next week, Monday at 1 o'clock. We'll continue our study of the Sefer Emunah Smecha. We'll jump back into it. Thank you very much. I hope everybody enjoyed looking at that article for last week and this week. And we'll get back to the Sefer next week. Have a great rest of the week. All the best. Shul Plotzker, thanks, Gareth, for you. Signing off. Talk to you next week. Take care.